Good morning. We are at the Freiburg New Church Assembly in week number two. Our theme is Mothers in the Bible. I'm Gard Perry, and I'm doing an introductory lecture and including Eve, the first mother of us all. So, welcome. In doing an introductory talk about mothers in the Bible, there's necessarily a need to touch on a variety of topics. There is one big idea I wish to talk about at the outset, however, which I'll return to at the end of the talk, and which in my view underlies the whole story in general and mothers in the Bible in particular, which is that this narrative, the main characters, mirror the inner life of human beings, what it's like to be human. And in particular, the inner life of regeneration and what the consequence of that might be for our inner lives, relationships, and our sensitivity to the operation of divinity at the core of our being. And you are invited, therefore, to ask, is that so? And if that is so, that this story is about your inner life, how is that so? What difference might that make? So in this talk, I'm going to share Swedenborg's view of the significance of the extended family in which is the form of the story. We'll list the main characters, highlighting the mothers, so you have an overview of the biblical narrative. I'm going to touch on the essentials of truly human community, which is represented by Eve, the beginning of the story. And then we'll look at that big idea, which is that mothers in the Bible represent affections for truth, with consequence for our inner lives that hold clues to who we are, to our relationships, and to knowing more about how God loves us, how God operates in our lives. So the characters in the Bible, mothers, fathers, and their children, is a story that is immensely human. In every sense of the word, there is both the very good and the very bad. The best of human nature and the worst is portrayed there. In terms of how bad things can get, I am reminded of a quip by Woody Allen who said, if there is a God, he better have a good excuse. Now, since hearing that, I thought of a pretty good answer. What would be God's excuse? Excuse for what, by the way? You don't have to answer, but why is that so funny? Excuse for what? But I did think of what God might come up with. Quote, I thought they would learn from their mistakes. In that light, the story of humanity's relation to divinity makes sense. God has given us the ability to make mistakes and to learn from them. And as we see throughout the week, as we learn more about this story, they as characters and we as humans are given seemingly insurmountable challenges and obstacles, distractions, detours, deficits. And remarkably, we often find our way through. Turning to my annotated Oxford Study Bible, we find about the book of Genesis, which means origin. This covers the time from creation to the Israelite sojourn in Egypt. It falls naturally, the book of Genesis, into two parts, the primeval history of humankind, where we meet Eve and others, And then the ancestral extended family history of Israel's ancestors. The migration of Abram and Sarai in response to God's promise is the turning point in this unfolding story. Out of fallible human material, God gradually separates a family line, promising the descendants of Sarai and Abram that they would increase in number, they would receive land, and they would have a relationship with God that would be a benefit to others. You shall be a blessing. This is a threefold promise which is threatened by various experiences, including Sarai's barrenness. And on account of Rebekah's actions, Jacob has to flee the land of Canaan. Despite these trials and tribulations, however, the people move toward the horizon of God's future. Now here we encounter commentary found both in the Oxford Study Bible and in Swedenborg that the history of the people of Israel in general and mothers in the Bible in particular is framed as an extended family story, relationships. And there is a reason for this, which Swedenborg explains in Secrets of Heaven, aka Arcana Celestia, in the following way. In most ancient times, humans were distinguished into homes, extended families, and nations. A home consisted of a wife and husband and children. An extended family consisted of a number of homes, while a nation was constituted by a number of extended families. The reason why they dwelt this way, in homes, extended families, and then a nation, was that spiritual community could be introduced and preserved. Life in the home of an extended family presented an image of a parent's love, reflecting in a human way divine love. Quoting still, it pleased the Lord in those ancient times that ancient humans should dwell in homes, extended families, and nations in order to mirror the characteristics of truly human community, which itself was like the kingdom of the Lord. For in the Lord's kingdom are innumerable societies, one distinct from every other, each according to its love and its faith. So that's why the ancient people lived in homes and extended families in that way. And we meet this extended family in chapter 12 of Genesis when Sarai and Abram leave their ancestral homeland, which, by the way, is in the Tigris and Euphrates area, modern-day Iraq. And they migrated from there north into what is modern-day Syria and were there living when Sarai and Abram received a call to go to, quote, a holy land that God would show them. And that's where the extended family story begins. And I'm going to take a step back and and sort of give the top 20 highlights that came to my mind in the story from beginning through Genesis. There are other mothers, by the way, about which you'll hear this week, and I'll let those presenters tell you who they are. But as far as Sarai is concerned, and Abram, they were called to leave their land to a land that God would show them, which is Canaan, called the Holy Land, and that they would be a blessing. And they receive a blessing there. However, and this story is just full of obstacles, challenges, things going wrong, things going right, a little bit like human life. There's a famine in the land. They go to Egypt. They return roughly the way they came. Sarai and Abram are separated from Lot. There is war. Sarah is barren. She enlists her handmaiden Hagar the Egyptian to give birth to Ishmael. Sarai is promised that she will bear a son who will be Isaac. A wife for Isaac, however, cannot come from where they're living. A servant goes to their ancestral homeland, meets Rebecca, brings her back, is married to Isaac. They have Esau and Jacob. Due to Rebecca's switching the two twin boys at the time of a blessing, Jacob has to flee for his life to go back to the ancestral homeland, where he meets Rachel, falls in love, and is given the older sister Leah instead in marriage, and then Rachel lives there for 7 years, returns, reconciles with his twin brother Esau, settles in the Holy Land where the 12 tribes of Israel, so-called, fan out and settle the land. Finally, there is another famine. They try to kill Joseph, by the way, as you will know, that wonderful, wonderful story of Joseph in Egypt where he prospers. They eventually reconcile and live in Egypt as the people of Israel, and things go very, very well until they don't. And they become slaves in Egypt, and that was what begins the book of Exodus. So that's kind of a bird's eye view of the history of this Sarai, Rebecca, Leah, Rachel, and their families in the Holy Land. And yet, their ancestral roots go back to ancient times where we meet Eve. So their spiritual roots. So let's talk about the essential nature of the human community of which they are a representative. Just for a moment, we have to go way back to Eve now, whom I'll introduce in this way. From verse 30 of Genesis chapter 2, and the man called his wife's name Eve because she was the mother of all living. She is called mother as being the mother of the first truly human community and living in the consequence of possessing trust in the Lord, which is life itself. Now, it's really interesting that Eve is not named until later in the story. She first appears, and I'm going to put it this way, as a rib in Adam, then as a wife, and is finally named Eve. The beautiful thing about our writings is you'll see right in the middle of this that Swedenborg said, and nobody in their right mind would ever believe that Eve was created out of a rib from Adam. That's simply, it's right there in fine print. Do you know how few people on the planet know that? That is the beauty of our teachings, is that story makes zero sense. But there's a spiritual meaning which we can take on board. And I'm going to use a little technical language just for the fun of it. The rib is natural proprium. A wife is a spiritual church. And Eve, by the time she's named, is unconditional love in a in the most ancient golden age. It's as good as life gets. It's life in the Garden of Eden. And this is the legendary ancient story and core out of which these people came and out of which we ourselves arise in our humanity. It was Eve and the fact, and I'll put it, Swedenborg, while Swedenborg can completely discount and dismiss the details of the story as making any rational sense, of course, in it, which it doesn't, he says there's a spiritual value to this story, which is that human beings do arise out of an unconditionally loving relationship with God in the most ancient times. People actually did live as one with each other and with God. Now, the story is about why that isn't true anymore and why it ceased to be true. But before we get to that, let's just take another, let's stay with this notion of what is a genuinely human community of which that's the core and which we might see as, for which there might be evidence in our experience today. So Swedenborg puts it this way in Divine Providence 4.4, a form makes a unity more perfectly, a form makes a unity, that's one, more perfectly as its constituents, its parts, are distinguishably different, yet united. So I'd like to give just two examples of this. One came up earlier in the week when one of our speakers talked about what, in this case, he believed ideal parenting can include. And now I look around the room and I'm seeing a lot of ideal parents out there. Okay, actually, sure, I was just asking, am I sure about that? At a certain level, yes. I have seen some wonderful examples of good parenting this week, by the way. And I'm going to back that up by what I kind of believe about ideal parenting. It includes, among so many other things, the ability to convey reality in a loving way, in an appropriate way, to a little person. Reality. And I have seen real parents just talking to their kids as if they're real. Okay, which reminds me of a great story of a little girl and a mother. Not an ideal parent coming up, by the way. Warning. A mother whose love will not let me go, something like that, goes into a restaurant. They sit down. The waitress comes up, says, "What can I get you?" The mother said, "I'll have an open-faced turkey sandwich." She looks at the little girl who's 7 or 8. "What would you like?" "I'd like a hot dog." The mother then looks at the waitress and said, "No, she'll have a turkey sandwich also." The waitress stops for a minute, has her pad there, looks back at the girl and says, "What would you like on your hot dog?" The girl says, "Mustard." Waitress walks away. Little girl looks at her mother and said, "Mom, the waitress thinks I'm real." Okay, well, anyway, so to illustrate that, the speaker in the previous week spoke about optimal parenting as the desire not to mold the child into what the parent thinks would be good for the child, but to wonder with curiosity what would be her gifts, what are her talents, what are his abilities, what would he be interested in, and to be curious about that. Bring them up in a way that they know they will belong by being who they are and wise enough to know they will be able to make some contribution. That's part of our job to guide in that way. And that is an example, this bringing up a child so that they understand who they are, what their true self is, not a false self. So that was just one example. The second one is from support groups that I facilitate, and they're for people that are hurting a lot. They've lost a loved one, and we need to create a nice, safe environment, kind of an ideal human community where we convey reality to one another. And I often say, here is a place you can come as who you are, not as who you think you're supposed to be. So that gives you a feeling of what ideal human community might look like. It's represented by Eve. It is found among ancient humans in a oneness with God. And yet, because they became individual people, which, by the way, is the symbolism of a rib, its natural proprium, which is a subjective self-awareness. What a wonderful thing, subjective self-awareness. We all have it. Without it, we wouldn't be, you wouldn't be who you are. You can experience your selfness, your individuality as you are. That's natural proprium. The problem is we can't stay there because it creates a sense of separation from others. So we develop what's called spiritual proprium, which is Eve as a wife. What's spiritual proprium? Is simply joining with others, being aware. You could experience it now as you feel yourself as an individual, where you are located. But your awareness can gradually open and you can feel both where you are and you'll sense people around you. And you could become sensitive to who they are. That's spiritual proprium. And then Eve as a wife is celestial proprium, and that's kind of like, ooh, getting behind and within and feel and sensing inflow, being cared for, being loved, God's love. That's celestial proprium. And our subjective self-awareness is a gift from God. It's not our own. And yet it seems like our own. That's celestial proprium. Okay, so that's the that's Eve in the Bible. We're going to hear this week about the individual family members, in particular the mothers in the Bible, the women who carry the story forward. Which brings me to the last point, and a very important one, which is these characters represent parts of ourselves that are working for us, and in particular our regeneration. So the mothers in the Bible represent affections for truth. So I'm going to read from the Arcana for a moment. It happens to be from the Standard Edition. There is a more modern translation, of course, which is highly recommended, is the New Century Edition. But this illustrates the difficulty of understanding some very big concepts. I'm quoting here. When we are being regenerated, we are kept in an affection for truth. And while we are in this affection, we seek truths from every quarter among knowledges in the natural. Now, I'm not sure how many of you are going to be memorizing this and repeating it to yourself today as like an affirmation. I'm going to read it one more time, and then share my interpretation. When we are being regenerated, we are kept in an affection for truth. And while we are in this affection, we seek truths from every quarter among knowledges in the natural. So just what does this mean? What does this mean? Mothers in the Bible are like parts of ourselves that are encouraging voices within us that tell us, open your eyes and see. See what? See other people. Wonder who are they, or who are you? Be engaged. Care about their well-being. That will another person's well-being. That is really going to open your eyes, because that's the definition of curiosity. What do you need? Should you, on the other hand, hold a grudge or feel anything less than a charitable attitude, true perception darkens into a false judgment. An affection for truth is looking for the good that can come from every relationship with another person and every situation, without exception. That's an affection for truth in interpersonal relations. Now, I suggest starting with interpersonal relations because it's easier to know what another person needs for some people than it is to know what you yourself needs. Other people are, their problems, their lives, pretty easy to figure out. One's own life, a little more complicated. It's best to start with learning how to relate to others with their well-being in mind, being curious about what's needed to solve a conflict. I'm reminded there was a child, I'm told, who was curious about why someone else was dressed that way. And the mother said, "Why don't you go and ask? Ask. You might find out." So that's an example of an interpersonal affection for truth, defined instead as curiosity. The natural, by the way, is our common sense world. We're in the natural world right here of interpersonal relations. So when we wish to see ourselves as our best selves, as the kind of person to which you aspire, seeing your own dark side, difficult emotions, realistically, and feel that even you belong, as you are insecurities and all, you are experiencing an affection for truth within your own life. And when you want to sense intuitively that every coincidence, indeed every moment, divinity is trying to reach us, help us on the way, that is an affection for truth in relation to divinity. We've now covered an overview by returning to the beginning. The Bible story as a whole, and mothers in the Bible in particular, is a journey about self-knowledge, more skillful interpersonal relations, deeper trust that the good Lord is with us at the core of our being, closer to us than we are to ourselves. And with that, I have written down, the floor is yours.
For anyone new here, we record the lectures, so we ask you to use a microphone so people listening to the recording can hear you, and to give your name so they know who you are.
Susanna Curry, when you mentioned about us having that curiosity towards others as a way to understand them, the converse is also true, and it just kind of struck me that we need to allow others to be curious about us. And that actually will help us with our self-awareness as well as their deepening awareness of us and our needs, because they mirror for us. When we're asked, what do you need or how can I help you, it allows us to go deeper in ourselves to figure that out, because as you say, we are often more of a mystery to ourselves than we are to other people. So just a reminder, I took it as a reminder to remain open to the caring that comes our way, because it will help us to understand that mystery inside.
Thank you, Susanna.
Guard is nodding.
Thank you, Susanna. Please.
Allison Lane Olson here. And Guard, I just wanted to thank you for your lecture and overview and reminder about Eve's life. And I was just thinking about what she went through as a mother. And it's a spiritual story, but thinking about Cain and Abel and what happened there, and then Seth coming along afterward. And I was just wondering if you could speak for a moment about, you know, that aspect of her life.
Well, the only thing that what's coming up is the story of humanity's relation to divinity. I'm going to have to kind of stay at that level. That's depicted in this ancient text, which is arose in our history before there was written language, depicting a unity between people, themselves, and God. So this was a golden age, I'm calling it, of peace and unity. We find evidence of this, by the way, in some ancient cultures, in addition to all the war and conflict and competition for survival. There are very profound instances of cooperation and peaceful community life as a basis for survival. Now, what happens immediately is Cain and Abel are born. These are the sons of Eve and Adam. And what happens? But Cain kills Abel. And this is a parable, so we don't know exactly what the circumstances are, although we do know that that type of violence exists. But it's a parable of a beginning of a decline from this golden age into a time of history, which is where our story of Mothers in the Bibles begins, where there was virtually no relation to divinity. And what I'm hearing Allison depict is that right away, things start to go wrong. And that's the oh-so-human side of the story. Julie Conneran,
yes, thank you.
Wow.
One of the most amazing things of this story is that it's about the most ancient church who were given the freedom to choose an alternate. Now, per se, God did not create evil. However, he allowed people to turn away, to be able to say, not interested in that. I mean, when I look back, sometimes I think, wouldn't it be nice if we'd have stayed that way? But we didn't. The same way as with our children. Wouldn't it be ideal if? But they don't. They become beings who can choose their own life, their own pathways. And we could say, wow, I wish we'd stayed in that golden age. But God, the divine Father, Mother, saw right from the beginning it wasn't going to stay that way.
Right. My question is, as anyone else who's thinking of another question while I'm speaking, please begin to form it. I wonder who really, really believes that, that I wish it would have stayed that way. So I'll say a few words about that, kind of an alternative to the alternative. It is a turning away in a sense. They wanted to be led by themselves instead of by God. Well, that right there is the definition of being a human. This is a story about being human. And we are led by ourselves. And rightly so. We are given free will to use. And those of you who are interested in the mental health field or have worked in it, know that agency, I think it's called. It's called will. It's called capacity. It's called self-knowledge. We are people as individuals who have to make decisions on our own. Now, that's a stage. That's really where I would go with this. Without that ability, you either have a mentally ill person or a person with a with a disability of a severe kind. So we need that. I can do it. It has to evolve, though, which is what we do here. We have rules of camp. We have our camp meeting. How do we get along with one another? A healthy community honors your need for independence. Autonomy, there's another word. Really, autonomy is what proprium is. It's a lovely thing. But wouldn't it be even lovelier, and this is where I'm going with Julie's comment, wouldn't it be lovely if we could transcend that? And that's called self-transcendence, and that's where we have the capacity as a human being to know ourselves and another person. And Swedenborg calls the highest form of love mutual love. That's where you have a playful competition, as a friend called it, where you want to do what the other person wants to do, you know, pleases the other person. But the other person said, no, I want to go on a picnic where you want to go this time. And you kind of, that's a beautiful form. That's celestial independence. So we have natural, spiritual, and celestial independence. Thank you for that.
Yes, I think, just to follow up on that, I think the kind of celestial beings we could be today are in many ways richer than those very early people.
Bingo. I mean, did I say bingo?
You did.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Behind you.
Laura Grahams. Yeah, I mean, it occurred to me when you were talking, is it's almost like we think, oh, darn, this wasn't supposed to happen. You know, and it's like we certainly wouldn't want that with our kids. We wouldn't want them to stay in that little golden age state when they just kind of think we're little gods. You know, we want them to go through these stages. So was it really an accident? Was it just an allowance, or was this always the grand plan?
Yeah, it's what I'm hearing is the opportunity to learn from mistakes, also the opportunity to grow when bad things happen. That was the book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Bad things happen. The question is, what do people then do? And that's where the good comes in. And that's where kids learn, hopefully. Okay. So. More discussion? So quiet. Okay, well, hearing no more questions, I'll say thank you very much. Yep.